Thank you, Mr. Porter. Happy Sabbath, everyone. Good to see you all. I'm not sure how many of us were pleased to see the snowfall this morning that had to be scraped off the windshields, but there it is. Maybe it'll reduce the ticks this summer. We can hope, anyway. How many of you remember an ad campaign that highlighted the differences between two different computer operating systems? There is a personification of the two operating systems. On one hand, one was shown to be young, rather svelte, hip in dress, well-spoken, had a friendly disposition. The other was a little more rotund, not quite a sharp dresser, perhaps more socially awkward, prone to gaffes of one form or another. And the purpose of the campaign was to highlight the inherent superiority of one operating system over the other. It was wildly successful, ran for quite a while, and had some very humorous commercials. They made, I think, most people chuckle, regardless of which of the two personalities they may have used on their regular daily lives. But they started with, "I am a Mac, I'm a PC," almost every time they started that way. And so they would talk about their own benefits. "Well, I'm good at making movies." "Well, I'm really good at making timesheets." And they would go back and forth, talking about their attributes and their characteristics. And somehow these would play back to their owners, I suppose, is what the intent of the ad was to do, to show, well, which would you rather be like, the hip one or the other guy? And a lot of parodies were made of these commercials as well. Well, I'm not here to talk about operating systems. Oh, good, I can see relief in your eyes. But I'm talking about the first part of the commercial, the "I am." The Gospel of John has a number of Jesus' statements as recorded by the Apostle John. So in the time remaining today, we'll look at those seven "I am" statements. We'll review Jesus' seven "I ams." The first "I am" we'll look at is found in John 6. If you turn with me, please, to the Gospel of John. We'll start reading in chapter 6. We'll read verses 32 through 35. And Jesus said to them, "I tell you the truth, it is not Moses who has given you the bread from heaven, but it is my Father who gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." "Sir," they said, "from now on, give us this bread." Verse 35, then Jesus declared, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry, and he who believes in me will never be thirsty." So Jesus declared that he was the bread of life. Let's take a look also at Revelation, the book of Revelation, chapter 7. Revelation 7, we'll read verses 13 through 16. So here the 144,000 have been enumerated. And then verse 13, and one of the elders asked me, "These in white robes, who are they and where did they come from?" I answered, "Sir, you know." And he said, "These are they who have come out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God, and they serve him day and night in his temple, and he sits on the throne, will spread his tent over them. Never again will they be thirsty, and never again will they hunger, and never again will they thirst." So we see a parallel here between these two accounts. "I am the bread of life." This is a little harder for us to identify with in our culture, in our society today, especially with the challenges we face with health. We have low-carb diets. We have gluten-free diets. And poor bread has taken a hit. We don't have the same cultural weight or emphasis on bread like we used to. as humanity. It was very important in the day, though, the bread of life. Bread was a staple. We have a few staples now, not the kind you put in staplers, but of the food variety, of course, of maybe rice or potatoes. As our tastes change, those staples change, and bread seems to be on the way out presently. But to get a better sense of how significant bread might be, it might be helpful to think of a comic I saw. I can't remember his name, but I do remember the observation he made, and that was about Mexican food. Do you like Mexican food? I enjoy Mexican food. It doesn't always like me, but I enjoy it. But Mexican food can be described, according to this comic, this way. Mexican food has an incredible variety of flavors, textures, types. And to describe it to someone who's never had Mexican food before, what could you say to them? Well, let's give an example of, say, the burrito. A burrito is a tortilla, in this case flatbread, with meat and cheese and lettuce. It's very good, and unlike any other Mexican dish. Then there's the taco. Well, that's a corn tortilla flatbread with meat and cheese and lettuce. But then there's the tostado. It's a tortilla with meat and cheese and lettuce. Well, then there's the taquito, very different than the others. See, it's a tortilla with meat and cheese. I could go on. Do I need to? The point is, bread is everywhere. In this case, the flatbread, the tortilla. That was the context that Jesus was talking about. Bread was served at every meal. It could also have been part of the cutlery. If anyone has been to a Middle Eastern restaurant, sometimes you dish food out of the platters using a piece of bread. There are no utensils for that. Or it may even be your plate where the food is collected. So bread in this case is not an ancillary or a supplement to the meal. It is a central, integral part of the meal. There's a paragraph out of our booklet, God's Holy Day Plan. I'd like to refer to that. In reference to this passage, it says, that means we accept him, that is Jesus, as the final authority in our lives. It means we hunger for him as we hunger for physical food. It means we desire to learn about him so we can become like him in every aspect of our lives. I am the bread of life. The second I am we'll look at is I am the light of the world. And for that, we'll turn to John chapter 8. John chapter 8. We're going to wear out the book of John today. John chapter 8, verse 12. Verse 12 says, when Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Let's take a look also at Isaiah chapter 8. And if you're like me and you have a bookmark, you might want to put it in John right about now. Isaiah chapter 8, and we'll start reading in verse 22. They will pass through the land greatly distressed and hungry when they are hungry. They will be enraged and will curse their king and their gods. They will turn their faces upward, verse 22, or they will look at the earth, but they will see only distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will thrust into thick darkness. Chapter 9, verse 1, but there will be no gloom for those who were in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the latter time he will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. Verse 2, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who've lived in a land deep of darkness, on them light has shined. Light is a marvelous thing. Our ancestors, who were the pioneers founding this nation, had a better appreciation of it than we do now, perhaps because it is so readily available to us. We hit the switch on the wall, and the light comes on. or we can even speak in our smart homes or talk to our smartphone and the lights will come on. But how about in a place where light is less available? When was the last time you were in a cave as a visitor, not as an inhabitant? I had a chance to go into, I think it was Mirmec Caverns when I was a younger lad. Even the cave had bell bottoms in those days. The cave had a tour that I don't think they have anymore now, where they take you to a dark cavern at the back where it's lit, and then they turn out the lights. Have you ever experienced that? I'm not sure they do this anymore because too many people freak out and insurance, liabilities. But back in the olden days, you could do this. They would turn out the lights, and it's amazing how thick that darkness actually is. Have you had that experience? And then the tour guide might light a match, and to see the brilliance of that one match, how much it illuminates, how comforting it is, especially when you feel panic set in right about here, to see that flickering light and how it gives warmth to that environment. But we have room lights. Depending on what variety of light you have, you might not appreciate the light bulb and change it out because it doesn't give the right appearance to the room. Maybe it's for a light to shine on a piece of artwork. It has to be the right color, doesn't it? The right hue. The color of the light bulb can affect someone's mood. We have different or special light bulbs that produce a special spectrum for people. We have them for plants, don't we? We also have lights for our yards. A couple of times this past summer, I wasn't sleeping well and slept on the couch upstairs so I wouldn't keep anybody else awake. And as I lay there, I became acutely aware of the neighbor's yard light. It was so bright, I could almost hear it. And it was for security reasons. We had some thefts in the neighborhood, and so that yard light was turned on. How about lighthouses? Lighthouses are very important. Maybe less so to us personally, but they serve a very important need to cast a warning to ships. Sometimes we see them as we drive on a cool or cold winter night, or on a warm summer night, a beam flashing in the sky. We know, we must be close to an airport because we can see that light beacon twirling around. Lights serve an important purpose. They can serve as security, but they can also serve as an alert to danger. The light of the world illuminates the world around us. It shows the beauty that's available. It also highlights the dangers that are available that we may not normally see in the darkness. But that is what Christ is. He illuminates these things for us and then asks us to reflect that light. We don't have a source of that light ourselves. We can only reflect it. But Christ said, I am the light of the world. The third I am the door of the sheep. I am the door of the sheep. And for this, we'll turn to John chapter 10. John chapter 10. Yeah, that was much easier with the bookmark. I'll start reading in verse 1. I tell you the truth, the man who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate but climbs in by some other way is a thief and a robber. The man who enters by the gate is the shepherd of his sheep. The watchman opens the gate for him and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought them out all his own, he goes on ahead of them, and his sheep follow him because they know his voice. I had an experience to try this out one time as a child. On Grandpa's farm, he would drive out in his pickup truck. Old Blue was its name, but it was new, but it was old. I don't know how this naming convention works. Old Blue, anyway. We would drive out in it, and he would have the window down because it was summertime, and he'd call out to the cows. And I don't even remember how he called them. He had some term that was hard for this Canadian to understand. I tried to repeat it because it worked so well for him. He would give this call, and they would come running. I'd give the call, and they'd stop. But it's very true. They do know the voice, don't they? But they will never follow a stranger. In fact, they will run away from him because they do not recognize a stranger's voice. Jesus used this figure of speech, but they did not understand what he was telling them. Verse 7, therefore Jesus said again, I tell you the truth, I am the gate for the sheep, or the door for the sheep. Ephesians 2. Let's take a look also at Ephesians 2. Ephesians chapter 2. Let's see, verse 13. But now in Christ Jesus, you who were far away have been brought near through the blood of Christ. Let's see, verse 17, I think, is what we're going to skip down to next. He came and preached peace to you who were far away and preached peace to those who were near, for through him we both have access to the Father by one Spirit. Not all doors are created equal, are they? Have you had an opportunity to replace a door in your home? A door that might look solid may in fact not be solid at all, but may be a hollow core door. I discovered that one time as a child by accident. They can be hollow on the inside. They have a nice veneer on the outside. They look like they're solid oak, even with the fancy panels on it. No, they're hollow on the inside. Some can look to be one variety of wood, but in fact be something entirely different, something cheaper like pine. So that fancy schmancy oak door is actually cheap wood. There is a family in the Toronto congregation who has come into a business making custom doors. And they put a great deal of work and effort into these doors. Some are very fancy. Most are fancy. Some are very fancy. And so, they go into fancy homes. Now, if you can imagine in your mind's eye, similar to what Mr. Thornton was speaking of last week, a brand new house. He was talking about all things new. Well, imagine a new house. It's your dream house. As Mr. Thornton painted this picture with the layout just right, the kitchen is maybe an open plan galley, the rooms have just the right lighting, the flooring, the walls are treated just right. The space is ideally suited for you, for your family, for your needs. And as you have toured the house, you can then go to the front yard and look at it from the outside, and you notice there's no door. That doesn't strike one as being a very secure home, does it? We all have doors for our homes. We have doors for our vehicles. We have doors to keep out that which we want to keep out. But the door lets in the owner. And here Christ is talking about him being the door, the security, the access. Christ said, I am the door of the sheep. The fourth I am we'll look at, I am the good shepherd. We'll go back to John chapter 10. John chapter 10, we'll read verses 11. I think verse 11 will do it. John 10, verse 11, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. It is reminiscent of the story of David when he is proving his worth to Saul. When the Israelites were camped against the Philistines and Goliath is uttering his curses across the valley and David volunteers to fight. And Saul says, you can't fight. Yes, I can fight because I took care of my father's sheep and was willing to take on these wild creatures with sharp teeth and claws. David was a good shepherd. And Christ is indicating that he is a good shepherd. He doesn't just say, I am the shepherd. He says, I'm the good shepherd. There are different kinds of shepherds, aren't there? Good shepherds, bad shepherds, ugly shepherds. But not all shepherds are good shepherd. But Christ is the good shepherd. Do you remember the story of the ship, the Costa Concordia? It's been in the news again lately. It was a cruise ship that made a tour of the Mediterranean. And as it was making the tour, the captain, Captain Scatino, made a pass close to shore. It was kind of a salute. How a ship is supposed to salute, I don't know. It doesn't have hands, but he was making a salute with his ship. He took it off autopilot because, as he said, he knew the local waters very well. Right, if I may quote Bill Cosby. So he took the ship off of autopilot and drove close to shore, closer to shore than he had previously, and hit a reef. And one side of the ship had like a 50-meter gash in it, flooding the engines. The generators were flooded. They lost power. They had steerage. But for some reason, the captain didn't inform the local port authorities that there was an incident, that they needed help, that they were starting to list, which means tilt. I had to look that up, which is a bad thing for a ship. Finally, he made a U-turn, and only after many delays, miscommunication, uncommunication, were people then instructed to head to the lifeboats. At one point, actually, there is video footage from smartphones or camcorders where staff of the ship were telling people, the emergency's over, you can go back to your cabins, and we'll all have a happy voyage. Not the case. The ship actually did nearly sink. If it wasn't for the proximity of the ocean floor, it would have sank. But it did come to rest. Most made it off alive. However, some did not. There were a number of fatalities. And this captain was actually taken to court, served time, because he abandoned his ship. He was not the last one on the ship. There were still 300-some-odd passengers on board, and he left. Not a good captain. Not a good shepherd. But Jesus said, I am the good shepherd. And he did lay down his life for us. The fifth I am the resurrection and the life. I am the resurrection and the life. Let's turn to John chapter 11. John chapter 11, we'll read verses 23 through 26. So here Jesus is comforting the family of Lazarus. He has purposely delayed. Lazarus is dead. Verse 21 says, Lord, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died, but I know even now God will give you whatever you ask. Verse 23, Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha answered, I know he will rise again at the resurrection at the last day. She understood the plan, didn't she? But not the entire plan. Verse 25, Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? And she gives her assent. Yes, I believe it. This past summer, I made a pilgrimage of sorts back to the family farm because we had learned my uncle was very sick. As it turned out, he was terminally sick. He had learned he had lung cancer after a prolonged period of what was thought to have been pneumonia. Turned out he had lung cancer, stage 4. And they gave him, I think it was 6 weeks, maybe 3 months. He lasted 3 weeks. But I was able to go out and visit and kind of say your goodbyes, which was important to do. And it was striking to see the change in my uncle. He had always been the strong one, the brawny one. He grew up on a farm. He was used to hard work. And I enjoyed helping with some of the farm chores in the summer when we would come and visit. And one of the chores I especially liked was hauling hay. Now, my family is not well known for surplus farm equipment. And so when it came time to hauling hay, whoever had a running pickup truck was the designated hauler. And someone would drive. As I got older, that assignment came to Grandpa, and he drove the truck, and the cousins and aunts would pitch in and grab the bales of hay and load the back of the truck. Now, some people were much better than others at placing the bale just right in that truck. They had a scheme worked out where you place the first four bales at the back a certain way and then the next three a certain way because of the wheel wells in the back of a truck, you know. They had it all figured out. They knew the science of loading a pickup truck till it almost collapsed, but they knew just that right point to stop. I trusted them, and it turned out they were right. Anyway, some of us weren't very good at throwing those bales of hay because we were city kids. But it amazed me at how my uncle could grab those bales with one hand each, and those strings didn't bother his hands. You know how tough those strings can be, the baling twine? It can really hurt your fingers. Didn't bother him any. He'd grab one in each hand, and he could, with each hand, throw the bale up, and it didn't matter how many levels were on that truck. He could throw it just the right height, have the bale turn and twist and rotate so it would land, making the person who was stacking the hay redundant. They had to be up there because of me and guys like me who could barely get the bale up there, and it could be a disaster at times. But not my uncle. He was always so strong. His wrists were so big, his forearms. He had muscle to spare, but not so this summer. He was a shadow of his former self. All of the things he enjoyed in life, especially being outdoors, were all but forgotten. Even the binoculars that he would use to spy out the deer or the turkey in the field, well, they were on a shelf because he couldn't do anything about it anyway. At that point, he was no longer living. He was existing. And what a time for a person to really come to terms with who is the resurrection. But Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. I think it was John Keynes who talked about economic theory and predicting what happens in the future. A lot of economists will try to give examples or try to predict how an economy is going to do in the future. But he said it best, in the long run, we're all dead. Not much hope unless you know who is the resurrection. Jesus said, I am the resurrection. The sixth I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. John 14. John 14. I'll start reading in verse 1. Do not let your heart be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I'm going there to prepare a place for you, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way, to the place where I am going. Verse 5, Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you're going, so how can we know the way? Good question. Verse 6, Jesus answered, I am the way and the truth and the life. Jesus identified himself as the way to get to that mansion. Have you heard of the town of Derby Line, Vermont? Maybe you've been there. I've not been there. I checked out their Wikipedia page last night, though. Having heard about this particular town and its sister town, Stanstead, Quebec, on a short-lived show, How the States Got Their Shapes. Have you come across that show? Very interesting for those who are map nerds like me. The host did a really good job of keeping it interesting. They're talking about border oddities between states, how they got panhandles, for example. And in this particular case, it talked about a border town between Vermont and Quebec, between the United States and Canada. When the town was founded in 1791, the idea of a border between British territory in the north and American territory in the south was somewhat vague. Of course, they understood the purpose for the border, but where exactly it was less relevant then, because they were still chopping down trees in order to see the next rise, perhaps. This was an ideal place for a town. We'll build it here. Trouble was, it was smack dab in the middle of a border. So this town actually straddles a border. There are family members who live on either side of the town. And up until 9/11, they would easily go across the border from one province to one state, from one country to another country, to deliver Aunt Mabel's mail, for example. And for generations, they did so. Well, now the border has been closed, obviously, because of national security reasons and because bureaucracies like rules. So the town now is essentially cut in half. Streets that used to easily go from one side to another now have barricades in them. And that is true except for, or most notably, the library, which was constructed by a family or a husband and wife, one was Canadian, one was American, right on the border, purposely so. So in this town, you can go in one side of this library. There is a tape across the middle of the library. On one side is one flag, on the other side is another flag. And you can freely go across as many times as you like. However, whichever side you came in through, that's the side you must leave out of. So you can, using a Dewey Decimal System, traverse the border as many times as you like, but you must leave the way you came in, which would be very frustrating. I think the nearest border crossing is at least 45 minutes away, so if you want to go across the street, it might take you an hour and a half to get there. It is a case of you can't get there from here, at least not legally so. I can see it. You cannot get there from here. This is not the way to get to the other side. You must use the appropriate channels to get there. In John 14, verse 6, Jesus said, "I am the way." The seventh I am the true vine. John 15. John 15. Verses 1 through 5, "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine grower. He removes every branch in me that bears no fruit. Every branch that bears fruit he prunes to make it bear more fruit. You have already been cleansed by the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me as I abide in you, just as the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me." In verse 5, he repeats it, "I am the vine, you are the branches. Those who abide in me, and I in them, bear much fruit, because apart from me you can do nothing." A vine is an interesting example of the case that Christ is making. Many of us are probably receiving seed catalogs this time of year for gardening. Have you received yours yet? We're already looking through ours, enjoying looking at the pretty pictures of the fruit that will get consumed by the weeds. But there's something special about a vine. It is not like other fruits that can be planted one year and immediately that same year fruit can be derived. It takes a vine longer. For a reference, you can turn later, Isaiah 5, 1 through 4. Look that up later. There is a lot of effort and planning that goes into planting a vineyard. A vine is an investment crop. There is a neighbor boy that comes over to our house to play with our boys, and he enjoys the garden that we have in our yard. I think more than the pretty plants, I think he enjoys the fruit that grows on the pretty plants, and wanted to participate, to be able to have his own garden, to have his own fruit. And so he began by asking, "Mr. Walzokoff, that peach tree, can you save me some seeds from your peaches? Because I'd like to grow some." They were quite sweet this year, so naturally when he tried some, he thought that it would be a good thing to have in his own yard. "I can save you some seeds. Not a problem." "Okay, now when I plant them, how long will it take before I can have some peaches?" "Well, that's going to take you 2-3 years. "Oh. Well, how about grapes, because we had some grapes too. Well, it's going to take you at least 2 years. How about raspberries? 2 years. Strawberries? I'll tell you what, if we dig up this strawberry plant and we put it in your garden, this year you can have strawberries. Well, that immediately made his day, and now he has his own patch. But these other fruits, the vine requires a lot more work, a lot more investment. And because of that investment, then the vine dresser takes much greater care of those vines than, say, the strawberry gardener, because there's less investment involved, less dedication to the selection of the location, the treatment of the soil, and then the upkeep of the vines. Christ is the true vine. There are different kinds of vines. He's the true vine, and only connected to him can we produce what he produces. We cannot do that intrinsically. We have to depend on the true vine. So we've looked at seven I ams. Not to sell one operating system over another, but rather to highlight some of Christ's characteristics through these statements. It reminded me also of another ad campaign extolling the virtues of a particular phone, which will remain anonymous. And in order to show its benefit, their slogan was, "There's an app for that." You've heard it, I'm sure. It's so wildly popular, even Sesame Street made a knockoff of it. There's an app for that. Well, in the course of our lives, we come to points where maybe we feel alone, we feel discouraged, we feel like we're not producing fruit. Well, in times such as those, perhaps we can ask ourselves, is there an I am for that? There is an I am for that.